Welcome into another episode of the Baseball America College Baseball Podcast. My name is Jacob Rudner. I'm joined, as always, by my co-host, Mr. Peter Flaherty. And Peter, it feels like every week when we do the show, we do a little countdown at the beginning where it's like, here's how many weeks we are into the season. Here's how many we have left. And this is now finally one of those weeks where we have what I would call a significant change to the calendar. The road for Omaha has reached its most critical stage. We're through the regular season. We are now getting ready for conference tournaments. A couple of them are underway. Columbia has already won the Ivy League as we record this on Monday, May 19th at 2 o'clock in the afternoon Eastern time. More to come in terms of automatic bids being locked up, but now is crunch time in terms of being able to determine the field of 64. And that's kind of what we're here to talk about today.
Yeah, it's go time. We've got it's going to be going at a breakneck pace both this week and really for the rest of the season, at least up until the eight for Omaha is decided. So it'll be fun to see how everything sorts itself out. This week, there's a ton to follow as we'll kind of get into whether your team is on the top eight national seed bubble, hosting bubble, just the bubble in general. As always, there'll be a lot of fallout from conference tournament week. So it should be a blast.
No, it really should be. And I think that one thing that people have noticed, if you've been listening to our podcast recently, we have become exceptionally postseason focused and how the field is going to shake out. And also I would encourage you, it's a good opportunity to head on over to baseballamerica.com/college, check out all of our postseason content. As we start to kind of try and forecast out the field here, we transition to daily field of 64 projections on Wednesday up until the field is actually announced. And trying to kind of break all that down has become a challenge this season in particular more than others. It's been very muddy, especially at the top of college baseball. We've talked about that on the podcast. With the proximity, though, to the postseason now, it's time for us to kind of rehash that. And I think with this episode, we're going to kind of go through the field and break down who stands where. So let's start at the top. Top eight national seeds right now. I think we have a much clearer picture than we did about a week ago of who belongs in that top eight. Maybe there's a spot or two up for grabs. Who are the teams that you kind of pencil in to that top eight national seed conversation right now going into conference tournament week?
I'm curious what your answer is. And I was thinking about it a little bit in the lead up to the episode and then also last night and just doing the top 25, but I think that there are probably five or six locks. I lean towards six locks heading into conference tournament week, and in no order. I think it's Arkansas, Georgia, Vanderbilt, Texas, Auburn, and I'm at five. And then I think North Carolina as well has cemented itself as a top eight national seed. So that's six right there. You could very well make the argument for seven with LSU. So I think that there is maybe a spot or two up for grabs this week. You know, if Coastal Carolina goes on a run in the Sun Belt tournament and continues its dominance in that conference, they could very well play their way into a top eight national seed. Like if Oregon, for example, does not win the Big Ten tournament, I think that is probably what needs to happen for someone like a Coastal to get in there. Oregon State is in a very interesting position because they're sixth in RPI. But obviously this year they're a Division I independent, so they're not a member of a conference. So their season until regionals begin is done. Again, they're in a great spot as far as RPI goes. I'll be curious to see whether or not that alone is enough with a lack of a conference tournament to get it in the top eight national seed discussion. And then I think as far as teams on the outside looking in, Florida State could play its way into that last spot or last couple of spots with a deep run or an ACC tournament win. I think the same could be said for Clemson. So long-winded answer short, I've got probably six teams penciled in right now, but the last two spots could go a number of different ways, but I'm curious where you're at.
Oregon for me, I think, is the weird one. I don't know how to evaluate where I stand on the Ducks. They won a share of the Big Ten, 22 conference wins in a weaker conference, 33rd strength of schedule. One thing that you and I have specifically griped over with Oregon throughout the course of the year is that they really haven't had a lot of prove-it opportunities. And granted, like, they have handled business when they have had opportunities to play quality teams. But I don't know if their strength of schedule and, you know, associated metrics are in line with that of a top eight national seed. Sometimes I do think that when it comes to college baseball, how you do in your conference tournament, how you do in terms of the regular season conference title can have a significant amount of influence. And for a team like Oregon, that could maybe be a saving grace. So I could see Oregon being in there. You mentioned Coastal Carolina. I really like that pick as well. I've kind of been bullish on them. I picked them to Omaha almost every week, in eight to Omaha, four conference losses. Is that the team that's going to go run through the Sun Belt tournament and win it? I would venture to say yes. And then maybe if you do that, also you kind of have that tournament regular season cachet on your resume that, you know, pushes you into the top eight. I still think it's on the outside looking in. LSU to me is the one that I think you mentioned them as a potential bubble for the top eight. I'd actually put them a little bit more towards the in than out. 19 conference wins in the SEC is a huge number. 42 total wins to end the regular season, number eight RPI, 13 quad one wins, 20 if you combine it with quad two, which is 11 quad one, quad two losses, just one quad two loss specifically. I lean towards that team being a top eight national seed. So I guess the moral of the story here is I actually don't think there's a lot of, you know, bubble action on the top eight national front. I do think that we know roughly who the first six, maybe seven, like you said, are. And then there are the Oregons and Coastals and, you know, LSU to a degree, Clemson maybe to a degree, if they can really go wild in the ACC tournament. The one that's really interesting to me, and we've talked about them just kind of being this hottest team in the country lately, Florida is kind of a weird one to me with the 13th RPI. I think that Florida would need to literally win the SEC tournament, and that would add, what is it, four wins to your resume in the SEC. And the, you know, the committee looks at those as just outright conference wins. So they're at 15 now. That puts you at 19, which is the number I just said for LSU. If you win the SEC tournament, I mean, you're probably a top 10 RPI team, somewhere between number eight and number nine. So I look at Florida as probably that dark horse to maybe make some noise and not only just get into the hosting picture, but like really vault itself high up there in that. But yeah, I think I go back to the what was looking pretty murky in terms of who would be the top eight to me has crystallized. The area that I don't know if I have as much clarity, at least in my head, as I kind of try and project here, is the number one national seed. I think that we have an idea of who that would be. And my quick answer would be Texas, just based on the fact that it had a historic season in the toughest conference in baseball. It still ranks towards the top of, you know, the RPI. I don't think that the current top teams in RPI above them, Georgia, Auburn, Vanderbilt, in that order, are number one overall seed caliber teams, maybe Vanderbilt if you had to pick from that group. But Texas, to me, top 15 strength of schedule, 40-plus wins, a ridiculous 22 wins in the SEC, 21 total wins and just 10 losses between quad one and quad two. This, to me, is the number one overall seed, but it's not as convincing as I think we've seen in years past.
Yeah, I think as far as the number one overall seed goes, you can probably whittle it down to, at this point, three teams, four, potentially, if you want to include Georgia in there. I think Arkansas is certainly in the mix. If it goes on a deep run in Hoover, certainly if it wins the SEC tournament, I think it earns the number one overall national seed. Same thing can be said for Vanderbilt. I think they fall into a very similar, if not identical, bucket to Arkansas as far as that's concerned. And then I think Texas right now is the leader in the clubhouse, just because, as you said, they had, they're fresh off this historic regular season. From a program standard, they won the SEC regular season title. I think that, not necessarily by default, but just given how everything's shaken out this year, I think that puts them in pole position. But I think that there is some to be played for in the SEC tournament. Like I think Arkansas could very well end up as the number one overall seed. Vanderbilt, Georgia, I think would probably have to win the SEC tournament, which feels strange to say, just given they're number one in RPI. They've got a top five strength of schedule. The metrics with the Bulldogs are pretty dynamite. So I think that they're also right there in the mix, but they might have a little bit more work to do than some of the other teams. So it'll be a fun race. I think it's a fun subplot to the SEC tournament, which every year is always exciting with, you know, wild games, late starts, whatever. But I think the only thing I know about the number one overall national seed right now is it'll be an SEC team.
So I guess that actually is the perfect transition to my next question for you, is do you think that there is a path for a team like North Carolina to get to the number one overall seed. And the reason I ask that is because they have a top eight RPI right now. We've been very bullish on them in the human poll, which is kind of the way that I like to refer to that. I mean, it doesn't really have any influence, but I do think that it is indicative of who's good when. Like, I think that we can agree that, does that have any indication on how things are going to shake out from a postseason standpoint? No. But does it show you who's been good and for how long? I do think so, because I think that we keep a pretty good pulse on the scene, and we're ranking teams based on what they're doing. And North Carolina has been, you know, one of our top 10 teams pretty much the entire season. So does it need things to break right for it? Is it impossible in your mind? Or like, where do you put North Carolina in this conversation? Are you dead set on SEC? Where are you at?
I'm pretty dead set on the number one overall national seed being an SEC team, barring like extreme chaos ensuing in Hoover, which would probably include a one and done showing for three, if not four, of those aforementioned SEC teams we talked about. I think North Carolina just has too steep of a hill to climb as far as the number one overall national seed is concerned, but I think they're solidly a top eight national seed regardless of what happens in the ACC tournament. They're number two in our poll. They're number seven right now in RPI. They've got really solid underlying metrics. I think they're pretty safely a top eight national seed at this point. So I think they need a ton to break their way. I don't even know if it's possible for that number one overall national seed, but they're still in an excellent spot from a postseason standpoint.
Yeah, no, that's kind of where I was at. I think though the breaks that could potentially occur are not as impossible as they may seem. You mentioned that there would need to be some early exits. Texas is probably the one that you need the most. And I think that Vanderbilt probably right there after that. Georgia, like you said, would need to probably win the SEC to have the number one overall national seed. Auburn seems like it's in the same boat. I think Arkansas is probably your first choice if, you know, a couple of those teams that I just mentioned have a tough go in Hoover or whatever the case may be. But I think North Carolina to a degree might control its own destiny a little bit. If you win the ACC tournament and, you know, some of these other teams that we just mentioned don't win their conference tournament, how much weight does that carry? If you're already close enough, are you already close enough? The RPI would say yes. I think the eye test would tell you no, just based on the quality of the SEC so far. But I don't think it's impossible would be where I land on North Carolina.
Yeah, it's an interesting hypothetical. I think, you know, winning the ACC tournament would be super impressive and give it a ton of momentum going into the regular season. I just think that it would probably need, at the very least, Georgia, Vanderbilt, Texas, Arkansas, and even Auburn to not win the SEC tournament. And I think the odds of that happening are slim to none. And you could even throw LSU into that bucket. You know, circling back to your point, they're sitting there with 19 SEC wins, 42 overall, top eight RPI team already, 20 quad one and quad two wins. So the deck stacked against it, but it's not impossible. So it'll be interesting to see, like, if everything goes haywire in the SEC tournament, what that means for a team like North Carolina, if it is able to run the table in Charlotte.
So North Carolina, we have firmly in a top eight national seed, it sounds like. We have Georgia, probably top eight national seed, Auburn, Vandy, Texas, Arkansas, maybe Oregon State, maybe LSU, Clemson, Coastal, Oregon, distantly Florida. We talked about Florida State in that conversation. All of those teams, I think it's important to note, bubble for the top eight, not bubble for a host. I think that maybe Florida would be the only one of the teams that I just mentioned that could go either way on the hosting line. Everybody else who I just said, I view as a surefire top 16 national seed. There are some hosting spots that are open though. And I think that they're open, you know, regardless of what happens with the SEC tournament the SEC tournament, but all of the conference tournaments. UCLA is in a weird spot, you know, just with 15th overall RPI. Yes, they have the share of the conference title, but 23rd strength of schedule. You only have three quad one wins. It's not necessarily the most surefire resume to me. An early exit in the Big Ten tournament could make things very interesting if stuff happens elsewhere in the country. Tennessee is on the bubble. TCU is on the bubble. Kansas, Ole Miss, Dallas Baptist, Georgia Tech, Southern Miss. Those are all teams that I would put in this bubble category to earn a top 16 national seed. What's your view right now, Peter, of the bubble as things stand heading into conference tournament week? And are we in a position where we could still see, you know, let's say 3-4 top 16 national seed spots get claimed, you know, between now and when Selection Monday arrives.
Yeah, it's certainly a murky bubble as far as hosting goes. You laid it out nicely. And I think I'll start by saying Florida, at the very least, probably needs one or two wins in Hoover to feel reasonably confident about its hosting chances. I'm not sure with the sub 500 SEC record, for as remarkable as its season has been, will quite be enough to earn a hosting spot when all is said and done. They're still comfortably a two seed at worst. But I think that they probably need a W or two to push it over the goal line. But I'm with you with UCLA. I don't think they can necessarily afford an early exit in the Big Ten tournament. Tennessee, I think, has to go on a deep run in the SEC tournament to reestablish itself in that hosting spot. TCU, if the season ended today, would host for me. And then what's really going to be fascinating is how the last spot or last couple of spots sort itself out, because you have that group of teams with Ole Miss, Dallas Baptist, Georgia Tech, and Southern Miss. Now, Georgia Tech, for me right now, it kind of looks the part of a hosting resume. And full disclosure, we haven't had our projected Field of 64 call yet, so it'll be interesting to see where Jacob and I settle on these final hosting spots.
This is like a de facto call. Doing it now.
Yeah. So, I mean, kind of like last week, you're hearing us talk through it live a little bit, but they've got 19 ACC wins. They're the regular season ACC champs. They're probably going to cross the 40 win threshold. They've got a top 20 RPI. The underlying metrics are reasonably favorable. I mean, for me, it's a hosting resume at this point, but then you also throw Ole Miss into the mix. They've got 16 SEC wins. They've got the RPI advantage. They've got 16 quad one wins. Southern Miss is a really fascinating one to me. I selfishly hope that they and Coastal play each other in the Sun Belt tournament, because for as dominant as Coastal has been in that conference this year, they have not played Southern Miss yet, who has been just as dominant, maybe a little bit less so, just given that they're 24-6 compared to Coastal's 26-4. But the Golden Eagles have ran through the SBC. They've skyrocketed to 21st in RPI. They've crossed the 40-win threshold yet again. They've got a dozen quad one and quad two wins. I think that they probably need to win. If they make it to the Sun Belt Championship and they end up getting knocked off by Coastal, I still think that might push them over the edge for a hosting spot. I don't necessarily think this is a win the Sun Belt tournament and you're in type of scenario for Southern Miss.
Can the Sun Belt get two host spots?
I think so. Absolutely. I think when you look at Coastal and Southern Miss, especially if they meet in the title game of the conference, I think Coastal's safely a host, barring something unforeseen. Southern Miss obviously has a little bit more work to do, but I think they're two very, very deserving teams. We've already talked about Coastal at length. It's been an unbelievable season under first-year head coach Kevin Schnall. And then Southern Miss, we also talked about, they've been dynamite as well. So they're two very deserving teams, at least from where I sit right now. And I think that they would be even more so deserving if they end up, you know, clashing in the SBC title game.
The team I didn't hear you mention that is really fascinating to me is Kansas. That's the one that I look at and I go, where do you evaluate this team to be? Because on one hand, you're talking about a group that has had statistically the best season in program history. They have the most regular season wins. They have the most conference wins, 42 total, 20 in the Big 12. They finished second to West Virginia, who they swept to end the season in the conference. But then you look at the strength of schedule, it's at number 72. The non-conference RPI is 50. Non-conference strength of schedule is 255, which is just way, way too low. You only have 10 total quad one games. They went 4-6 in those opportunities. Clean in quad two through four, though. Very clean. 11-4 in quad two specifically is a number that stands out to me. And then you have the number 23 RPI. Is this a team that can host? Because West Virginia is not a host. We can agree on that already out of the Big 12. You would currently pencil in TCU as the Big 12's representative in the top 16 national seeds, as would I. But I don't think that the gap is that big between TCU and Kansas. And I do think that we will see one Big 12 host. And I think my money would be right now that it's one of TCU or Kansas.
Yeah, I think that's a pretty safe bet. And to answer your question as to whether or not Kansas can host, it absolutely can. I think right now it's on the outside looking in, and would absolutely fall in the bucket of two seeds I wouldn't want to play. But if they, I don't even think they need to win the Big 12 tournament necessarily to push itself into the hosting picture. I think where it lacks, you know, quad one wins, non-conference strength of schedule is okay at 72. They've made up for, at least to some extent, with its 20 conference wins, 42 overall wins. They haven't really had like a super like big time dud of a series loss or midweek loss that's hampered its resume and kind of anchored it down. But I think with a meaningful run this week, it can push itself into that hosting discussion and be the Big 12's representative. And if they win the conference tournament, I don't even think it's a question as to whether or not they host. I think they'd be a lock, but they can certainly push itself into the picture with a couple of wins or a few wins in the conference tournament.
You mentioned that you would not want to face Kansas if it were to be a two seed. I think we can both agree with that. There are a couple others. Northeastern is a great example of a two seed that will not host. They will not be a three seed, and I wouldn't want to play them. I want to talk about two seeds that we don't want to face. Guys that are just pesky two seed profiles that are going to be messy to have in your regional. I will rattle off a couple for you, and then I'm going to have you give me your list, and we will discuss them. But the two seeds that I would hate to have in my regional right now are the teams that we just mentioned on the hosting bubble. So anybody that doesn't get into that, we're talking Kansas, Southern Miss, Georgia Tech, if they're not going to host, although I think they will, Dallas Baptist, which might not host. I wouldn't want to host them. Ole Miss is in that category. TCU, if it doesn't end up hosting. Kansas, obviously the same. UTSA is a team that we didn't discuss because they're not going to host this year that I would not want in my regional as a two seed. UC Irvine, Northeastern, Wake Forest, West Virginia to some degree, maybe Louisville. These are teams that I would not want to see if I was a regional host as my number two in my bracket. Who are the teams, Peter, that stand out to you in terms of just nightmare number two seeds that we don't think are going to host, but will probably not fall below the three line if, or the two line, I should say, you know, with a poor performance in the conference tournament?
Yeah. So for the sake of the discussion, I won't re-bring up the teams we discussed. Like, obviously, if Georgia Tech for some reason doesn't host, Southern Miss doesn't host, DBU, Ole Miss, TCU, Tennessee, Florida, the list kind of goes on a little bit. I would be groaning on Selection Monday if I see any of those teams as a number two seed in my region. I don't think that's at all a reward for hosting, but that's just kind of the way it goes sometimes. But UC Irvine certainly falls into that bucket for me as well. Northeastern, Duke, I think, is a dangerous team. NC State, the same can be said for them. You mentioned UTSA. They've been outstanding. They can't quite play its way into a host, but I don't want them to get overlooked. Coach Hallmark has been unbelievable in his time in San Antonio, and this year is a perfect example of that. So I don't want to say it like, I think there's so much parity this year in college baseball. Like, we've seen it in the volatility in our poll on a week-to-week basis, even like recently, just the revolving door in the number one spot. And we were very close to having another new number one this week if it wasn't for LSU winning back-to-back games. So I think there are a number of two seeds that can go on a really deep run and have College World Series upside, especially like Northeastern, I love. Southern Miss, if it doesn't get that one seed, certainly falls in that bucket. Georgia Tech as well. Really, any of those hosting bubble teams, I feel pretty similar about. And you can even go a little bit deeper. Like, I think that there are some three seeds that could go on a really deep run. Southern California, they stumble a little bit down the stretch, but I think that they're, you know, they're comfortably in the field, and I think that they're pretty solidly a three seed. So, I think the parity, hopefully, and I think will make it one a chaotic conference tournament week, which could be a harbinger of the NCAA tournament and regionals and supers and all that. Because I think, you know, there are a number of teams that could end up making its way to Omaha. So the two seeds are just the start of clubs I wouldn't want to see.
I'm going to put you on the spot here, Pete. Give me one two seed that you think has the best chance of making a run.
It's a great question, and it's a really, really tough question. Are we, I guess, for the sake of making it easier on myself, or can we eliminate those that are on the hosting bubble. So like Southern Miss, Georgia Tech. All right. So
anybody who we talk. So let's actually. Let me make this clear for our audience here. We're gonna draw the line at Florida. So Florida would be the team that I think is probably the most on the bubble, just with its, you know, conference record, and it has a well below 500 record against quad one teams. That's going to be kind of a heavier lift. They need to win games for sure to get into the conference tournament to get into the NCAA hosting picture. Southern Miss to me is another one. So like that pocket, anybody who we just talked about will keep off limits, but the UC Irvine's, Northeastern's, Wake, you know, West Virginia, those teams to me are all on limits.
Well, that's perfect, because my team is, I guess, somewhat easily Northeastern. We've kind of been beating their drum for a few weeks now. They've had an historic regular season. They lead all of Division I with 45 wins. They're 25-2 in the CAA. They just steamrolled their way through that conference. And I think how it will be able to get to Omaha is on the backs of its pitching, which has been unbelievable all season. It's 2.94 team ERA, leads the country by almost half of a run. Western Kentucky is in second. Coastal Carolina actually is in third. But it's going to get there on the backs of its pitching if it's able to go on this Cinderella run. That tandem of Will Jones and Avan Cabral at the top of the rotation has been outstanding. And it's interesting because they're not necessarily the antithesis of what college baseball is nowadays, but it's a rare breed. Like, they're two guys that really, really know how to pitch. It's comfortably plus pitch ability. They can locate their entire arsenal. They're not going to blow you away from a velo or a pure stuff standpoint, but they really know how to pitch, stay off the barrel, locate, avoid hard contact. And it's worked out exceptionally well for them. And those are two guys that I think you can feel supremely confident in giving the ball to in a regional setting. And then on top of those two, Cabral and Jones, there's a ton of depth. Like, they're not going to be screwed in, I guess, after those two bullets are unloaded, per se. Like, Jordan Gotsman has been great, a grad transfer. He's got a 2.4 ERA with 79 Ks and 71 and a third innings. He fits into that mold of, again, pitchability over stuff, can locate, doesn't get hit around all that hard. And then in the bullpen, the duo of Charlie Walker and Brett Dunham have been outstanding late in games. Charlie Walker at one point led the country in ERA. Brett Dunham has been kind of an anchor as well when the ball's not been given off to Walker. And then there are a host of other arms that I didn't even mention that, you know, you can use them late in a game. You can use them in kind of a bridge role and give you 3, 4, 5 innings in relief. You can start them. Like, there is not a single option on the pitching staff that I don't think Coach Glavin feels really confident in. Now, it's certainly a pitching heavy team, but one guy on offense in that lineup to keep an eye on is center fielder Cam Maldonado. One of the more impressive college draft prospects in the Northeast this year. He's hitting 375 with 30 extra base hits, 28 bags, 57 RBIs, really fun and intriguing tool set, pro body. He's going to lead the charge offensively, but it's an older, experienced group. I think they're going to have just kind of a low, slow heartbeat, not be overwhelmed by the bright lights. And I think that just depending on its matchup, both in its regional and then who it might see in a super regional, I just think its pitching depth bodes really, really well for a deep run.
The best piece of financial advice I've ever received is to pay yourself first. That's why now with every paycheck I receive, I start by putting a little bit away for those rainy days. Today's episode is sponsored by Acorns. Acorns is a financial wellness app that makes it easy to start saving and investing for your future. Acorns lets you get started with the spare money you've got right now, even if all you've got is spare change. You don't need to be an expert. Acorns recommends a diversified portfolio that can help you weather all of the market's ups and downs. Using Acorns, before I knew it, I had a couple thousand dollars in a little nest egg account. Sign up now and join the over 14 million all-time customers who have already saved and invested over $25 billion with Acorns. Head to acorns.com/darkparanormal or download the Acorns app to get started. Paid non-client endorsement. Compensation provides incentive to positively promote Acorns. Tier 1 compensation provided. Investing involves risk. Acorns Advisors LLC, an SEC registered investment advisor. View important disclosures at acorns.com/darkparanormal.
I I'm just going to go with a risky pick as well here. I think that Northeastern is risky in the sense that we haven't really seen it play anybody yet. They have not played a single ranked opponent. I believe they don't have any quad one games at all yet, right? There's still no Q1 games.
Correct. No, they're three and four
in Q1. Okay. Well, still, I mean, limited sample size against great teams. We've not seen them play a ranked opponent. I know that for sure. So there's risk there. Number 182 strength of schedule. I will go with somebody who's played a slightly harder schedule and has played now 10 quad one games, but right above the Northeastern in the RPI right now is number 24, UC Irvine. They've taken a tumble recently, and that has been the byproduct of two really ugly series. The first one against UC San Diego, which they lost, basically removed them out of the hosting picture. And then any hope that was still remaining left, you know, it was completely wiped out this past weekend against Cal State Fullerton when they dropped 2 of 3. But this is a team that still feels really well built to me. It's a deep offense with guys like Colin Yeaman, who we've talked about on the podcast, Jacob McCombs, who we've talked about on the podcast, Anthony Martinez is a top, let's call it 150-ish draft prospect for this year. I think Riley Kelly has probably inserted himself into that kind of a range. From a draft perspective, he's a pretty good Friday night guy. And then you have bullpen pitchers like Max Martin and Ricky Ojeda, who are All-American caliber relievers and have had fantastic seasons. Those are the ingredients typically that lead to deeper runs. When you have depth in your lineup, like you talked about with Northeastern, when you have pitchability, even if it's not necessarily the flashiest stuff in the world, which I think is the case for UC Irvine beyond the guys who I just mentioned of Martin and Ojeda and Kelly. And then those three guys are, you know, actually really good stuff. I mean, we're talking about three legit pitchers who have both the, you know, gamer mentality that I think you need as a two seed that wants to go on a run. And then you have the pitchability of some of the guys behind them. Trevor Hansen comes to mind as somebody who I think is really good in terms of just being able to dominate college hitters and be a gamer and go win. And so I still think that UC Irvine has the goods in the tank to be able to go on a run. Am I as confident that that's the case as I was about that maybe 2 weeks ago? No. But I still feel good. And I think that, you know, Ben Orloff, head coach Ben Orloff, is somebody who I think will have a chance to make some waves, whether it's this offseason or an offseason in the near future, as a big name hire on the coaching scene.
Yeah, I'm happy you mentioned the Anteaters, because I was wrestling between them and Northeastern for my pick. And I think recency bias might have people a little bit lower on them than in the middle of the year, just because they've lost two of their last three series to UC San Diego and Cal State Fullerton. It's really just been their only two duds of the season. It's been an impressive body of work overall. And obviously they're not coming at a great time because it kind of knocked them out of the hosting picture and has boxed them into that two seed range. But I don't necessarily feel all that different about it and the upside it has going forward. It's an impressive group, and it's for all the reasons you mentioned. There's depth on both sides of the baseball. It's an experienced club. Coach Orloff is an excellent guy to have leading your team. And so, similar to Northeastern, it depends on what draw they get. I'll obviously feel more or less confident depending on where they are stacked up in the bracket when it's released in a little less than a week. But I'm with you that it still has that College World Series type of upside. So it's a team that is as dangerous as they come from a two seed perspective. And I'm excited to see what it's able to do in June.
All righty. Well, we've talked about the positives. You got top eight national seeds. You've got the race for the number one, the bubble for hosting, nightmare number two seeds, maybe a couple three seeds that we mentioned in there that you don't want to face. Now I want to talk about the bubble, the not so good. Who is in and who is out at the back of our field? And this year, one of the themes, and we've been talking about this every single week, we've mentioned it on this podcast already multiple times, is that murkiness across college baseball, the parity that Peter was talking about a couple minutes ago. It has had an influence on the back end of the postseason picture. And I think every week, just to kind of give people an insight onto what our process is like at BA when we try and kind of shake out who belongs where, the bubble has been hard for us to try and determine. I think that there's been a lot of debate this season about, you know, is this a year where the Southland can get two bids if it performs well to end the season? The answer to that now is probably not. Is the Big East a conference that's able to get multiple bids? The Big West, we just talked about UC Irvine. Cal Poly now to me is a team that's on the wrong side of the bubble. Even the SEC has bubble teams. ACC's got a couple bubble teams like Notre Dame and, you know, I guess you could say Virginia still is in that picture, although I think I'm a little more confident in them now than I was a week ago. The moral of the story here, though, Peter, is that there are a lot of races still undecided as we enter conference week. And I do think that there are multiple areas where teams can kind of solidify their case when it comes to being a bubble team and getting off of that or moving the wrong way. I mean, I mentioned a couple teams just now who I think are in a reasonably positive situation. I would throw groups like Arizona State, Oklahoma State, Xavier, who I said I talked about a second ago, Creighton is in a weird spot right now, Southeastern Louisiana, UTRGV. All these programs are in weird spots in terms of being able to get into the tournament, especially this year with how top-heavy things can get with these conferences expanded and how the committee is going to view all of that. Where are the most interesting bubble battles for you? And are there teams that you think are kind of like, you know, this one's in for me more than other people are talking about? Who are the teams that you're really going to try and push into the field when we have our next Field of 64 conversation?
It's a good question. It's a tough one because our theme of the podcast has kind of been this cloudiness and murkiness. And man, this fits that description to a T, and I'm kind of struggling where to start. I guess in the Southland, and I guess it kind of speaks to our point when we initially gave it a ton of love with how deep it was as a conference. I don't think Southeastern Louisiana or UTRGV gets in the field now at this point. I think that they lack the juice of a typical at-large resume. Like UTRGV's RPI is just 45, and they only have two quad one wins. And I don't think, again, are they one of the 64 best teams in the country? Probably, but for better or worse, I don't think that's enough to get a team from the Southland in the field of 64 from an at-large standpoint. Southeastern Louisiana at 58th in the RPI. Their strength of schedule metrics aren't great. They have no quad one wins. They're not getting in. So at the end of the day, it's going to be a one bid conference, and it comes down to this weekend series between New Orleans and Houston Christian, both of which have been fun stories. So the Southland for me is a one bid league. It's whoever wins that series this weekend. The Big 12 is in a really interesting spot. All of a sudden, after Oklahoma State's sweep of Arizona State, Oklahoma State did the baseball version of the Undertaker meme of him sitting up ringside in the coffin. Because I think for me right now, both Oklahoma State and Arizona State are in. And I think the most notable part of that statement is that Oklahoma State's in. All of a sudden, they have a top 45 RPI. They've got a top 12 strength of schedule. They've got 14 quad one and quad two wins. I think it would certainly help its case if it makes a little bit of noise in the conference tournament. But nonetheless, I think they're in a good spot. The one team I have a close eye on, though, is Notre Dame. And they've been one of the hotter teams in the ACC, at least one of the hotter teams that have been on the bubble in the ACC recently. And I think if I were forced to say whether or not they were in, I think this weekend series win at Miami pushed it onto the right side of the bubble just barely. They're sitting there right now at 40th in the RPI, 14 and 16 in the ACC, decent underlying metrics, especially its top 50 strength of schedule. I think for it to feel totally safe, even just one win in the ACC tournament, I think would take a lot of stress off that program's shoulders from a tournament standpoint. And then the same goes for Virginia. I think they're more in than Notre Dame, but a win in Charlotte all but locks it up from an at-large standpoint. And then just bouncing around a little bit more, Cal Poly is an interesting case in the Big West. It's like kind of the similar argument to the Southland. It's like, is Cal Poly one of the 64 best teams in the country? Yeah, for my money, they are. But for better or worse, if you're a team from the Big West and you're not inside the top 40 from an RPI standpoint, they have the 99th best strength of schedule, and they're just 2-10 in quad one games and 3-12 in quad one and quad two games. Like, I don't necessarily know if that's enough to get it done.
It's not. It's simply not. Sorry to interrupt you, but I mean, there's no way. We have seen, there's precedent for this. I mean, we've seen out of the Big West when teams have not had metric. UC Irvine is a great example of this. UC Irvine 2 years ago or 3 years ago was right in the same position, weaker strength of schedule, didn't have, you know, a top 35 RPI out of the conference, didn't make the field. And it was viewed as one of those snubs. I don't even think Cal Poly's in that conversation in terms of being, you know, on Selection Monday one of the big snubs. Continue. Sorry.
Yeah, no, I'm happy you interjected because you're spot on. And I think in a little bit of a similar breath, I think we got to talk about Western Kentucky and Iowa. Like, Western Kentucky was kind of this, I don't want to say America's darling, but they're one of the better stories in college baseball for a little bit. They got off to this blistering start. They still had a really good season. They finished 42-12, 18-9 in the Conference USA. But like, for me, I think they got to win the CUSA tournament to get into the field and at the very least make a serious, serious run to the title game, because it's 48th in the RPI. It has the 189th and 285th best strength of schedule and non-conference strength of schedule. It's got just 3 quad one wins. Like, that right now is not an at-large resume. And then Iowa, for me, they have to win the Big Ten tournament this weekend. Not to mince words, but it was a total dud. They got swept handily against Oregon. They have how teams pass their biggest test with flying colors. They have failed their 2 biggest tests of the season with failing with flying colors. They went 0-5-1 against Oregon State and Oregon. That was kind of their grand audition, I guess, or biggest stage of the year. They fell totally flat. They're now 73rd in RPI. They have no quad one wins. Their underlying metrics aren't great. Like, that's a team that has to win its conference tournament to now get in. So that was kind of a long discussion by you and I. I'm sure I'm missing teams. I think the Big East is a fascinating one. Maybe you can touch on it a little bit. It'll be interesting to see how those 3 teams are tiered out. Obviously, UConn for me, I think, is pretty safely in the field at this point. And then it's Xavier versus Creighton. It'll be interesting to see how that sorts itself out.
Yeah, I mean, I lean towards Creighton being in a not too horrible bubble spot. I would actually take Creighton right now over Xavier. I think that Creighton has some head-to-head stuff that looks pretty good. But the issue is going to be the RPI, and that's going to be the case for a lot of the teams that we're talking about. At number 50, with the number 176 overall strength of schedule, they haven't even played a quad one game this year. I don't know that Creighton really has that compelling of a case to be able to get in right now. Xavier, to me, is slightly more compelling. They're at 38 in RPI, 38th overall strength of schedule. They did really challenge themselves in the non-conference, which is really something that stands out to me. Number 4 non-con strength of schedule. And we do know that, you know, the baseball committee does place a lot of value in how much you challenge yourself. It's the reason that Florida, for example, even had an opportunity to make the tournament last year, despite being 2 games over 500. But Xavier's 5-12 against quad one teams. And so I don't know if that's strong enough to get in without a tournament win. UConn's right there at 39. They're 7-12 in quad one. So I'm not convinced that the Big East has the resume to push multiple teams in. It's going to be close. That's probably the closest conference for me. And then there's one other thing that I wanted to circle back on that you said that I thought was really interesting. You know, Oklahoma State being in a position to get into the tournament potentially is really surprising, just given everything that they've dealt with this season. There's been injuries. There was a horrible fire situation that happened in Stillwater earlier this season that wiped out a weekend for them that could have been very valuable. So we're talking about a group that has had, a mixture of bad luck and underperformance, and it is still a talented roster with some early draft talent. And it just hasn't come together this year, but it has now. They beat Arizona State and have swept them and have now put themselves in a position where, look, if ASU is going to get into the field, I think you have to include Oklahoma State and vice versa. If Oklahoma State's going to get into the field, I think Arizona State has to. And if one of those teams is going to miss, I think both need to. So that's interesting to me. The part that I want to focus on is Arizona State for just a second here. I struggle with the idea that Arizona State, with the amount of talent that it has on its roster, should even be in the conversation that we're having right now. I remember you and I were talking about this earlier in the year, maybe a couple weeks in. This is one of the most talented rosters in the country. Forget the Big 12. I mean, they have ample draft prospects. I believe at the beginning of the year, among our top 200 ranked prospects for this year's draft, ASU had more than any other Big 12 school. So we're talking about a team that will out-talent most other teams in its league when it comes to draft time, and it'll be reflected in average draft position and total drafted players. The fact that it is a very clear 3 seed and maybe even on that do you even make the tournament bubble is a really bad sign for a historically excellent program. And that is equally as surprising to me as what you said about Oklahoma State now being back in the picture.
Yeah, I mean, full disclosure, like before the season, I was close to putting in Arizona State as an Omaha sleeper in the 8 Omaha sleepers piece I did. I wouldn't have batted an eye, and I don't think you would have either, if someone came and told us on January or in early February that ASU would be a host. When all was said and done, like, it's a supremely talented roster. Like, there are 8 legit bats in that lineup. And just to rattle them off quick, Matt King, Kian Vu, Landon Harrison, Kyle Walker, Isaiah Jackson, New Contratus, Jacob Tobias, and Brandon Compton. Like, that is a legit lineup that you can roll out on a day-to-day basis. And then obviously it's an offensive centric team, which isn't a knock against it, but even on the mound, you have, you know, Ben Jacobs anchoring that rotation, Jack Martinez, who has kind of emerged as a really viable option for them and has improved his draft stock in the process. Cole Carlone has been one of the best relievers in the country. Derek Schaefer has thrown the ball well since transferring from Tennessee as a sophomore. Josh Butler, Lucas Kelly have all thrown the ball well. It's like, why is this team not winning games, and why is this team not flexing its muscle more? And I think it's a puzzle that a lot of people are trying to solve. But yeah. I guess on the flip side, to end on a more optimistic note, like, you talk about all that talent, who knows if it's able to click at the right time in June and they're able to go on a run. Like, from a 3-seed standpoint, at least from an on paper talent perspective, like, that's probably as talented as it gets. But is it going to be able to put it together is the biggest wild card. And that's kind of been the question in each of the last few years. And the biggest what if is, like, what if Arizona State puts it all together, and is it going to be able to put it all together? So very fascinating season in Tempe.
Yeah, and I think that that's probably the best way to put it too, is, like, this is a team that you would expect to do better. And the fact that we're asking these questions is a little bit surprising, is what I would say at this point. Like, I don't know why we're having to wonder what Arizona State is from a postseason standpoint. The other thing that I'd kind of point to as a red flag for me is that what you mentioned about the offensive and pitching breakdown. This is a team that's offensively heavy and they have a lot of offensive talent. But then you mentioned Martinez and Carlone and Jacobs, and it's like, how isn't this team pitching a lot better than it has been? And I would go and look at the last couple of years too. I mean, ASU has had pitching talent under Willie Bloomquist that has fallen flat, completely flat. And it's like, you're not beating the teams that you are clearly more talented than. And, you know, at this point in the year, to be at March 19th and having a conversation about whether or not Arizona State is in the field or not, or, you know, even the fact that it's a 3-seed and not in the hosting line, that is surprising to me, because, like you said, I do think that that's a team where, if we had looked at them before the season and somebody said, hey, this is a team that's going to host, or hey, this is a team that's going to be one of the, you know, top surefire 2-seeds out there, I would not have batted an eye. Had you included them in your preseason, you know, Omaha sleepers, I would not have batted an eye. Now I don't view them that way at all. And instead, it is more of a question, like you just said, of, is this a team that can click at the right time? Or do we continue to see the level of underperformance that has gotten them to this point?
I think it's a great question. And I think that, again, if you had asked me on opening day, or even, you know, after opening weekend or the first couple of weekends, if it was more likely that Arizona State would be fighting for a host spot or squarely on the 3-seed line, I would have probably laughed at you and said, without a doubt, the hosting line. But here we are, and I think that they'd get put in a really sticky situation. I think that they're still safe as far as making the tournament goes, no matter what happens. But, man, it'll be a lot more of a stressful selection Monday if they don't put some points on the board in Arlington, because I think that they need probably just – I don't think they need anything necessarily, but I think that it would help them sleep a lot easier for the next handful of days.
All righty. Peter, it is time. It's that time. It's picks to click time on the Baseball America College Baseball podcast. For those of you who are new to the Baseball America show, Peter and I have played a game all season long called Picks to Click. It's where we go back and forth and pick a hitter or a pitcher every single week. Those guys then go head to head based on their statistical performance, and then we determine who won based on who they picked. We had an interesting regular season. We divided it into two parts. First half, I was the winner. I went 6-2 in the first half. And then you tied things up, actually. I did the math, Peter. We are tied 7-7 through 14 weeks because we stopped in the midpoint of the year. We made it two separate games, first half, second half. Wouldn't have mattered even if we didn't. You caught up. And so now we head into our third phase of picks to click, which is postseason picks to click. And this is the tiebreaker. This is for all the marbles now because of how this last couple weeks have unfolded. And here is my idea, and I will tell the audience this as well. This is all new to Peter. I have not told him any of this prior to the show. Peter, for the postseason, we are going to pick a pitcher and a hitter week. So you can score up to 2 points, and we will determine who has the most points at the end of the postseason. We'll pick every single week, including through Omaha. I think in Omaha, actually, we might pick multiple times. But this is the final format. So without further ado, we're going to start with our hitters, and I'm going to have you go first. Who is your offensive pick to click?
Yeah, first, I think your math is a little generous on my side, but I won't complain. But I'll start with my hitter. I'll go with Carson Tinney from Notre Dame. He's been one of the hottest hitters in the country in the second half of the season. He's now hitting 350 with 17 homers, 53 RBIs, almost a 1-1 K to walk ratio, strong physical kid, plus bat speed, plus power with some present hit ability. He's certainly in the discussion for the top catcher right now in the 2026 class. And he's kind of been the big time spark that has carried Notre Dame towards, if not onto the right side of the bubble. So I think it continues this week. And I think he's going to have a really productive ACC tournament in Charlotte.
All right. Well, I'm going to go with somebody who I think does a really oddly excellent job of getting hot at this time of year. And he does it almost every single season. I'm going to go with Florida outfielder Ty Evans. And the reason for that is exactly what I said. For whatever reason, Ty Evans seems to figure out a way to get hot right at the end of the year. Last year, he was great for Florida down the stretch until he broke his wrist. The year before that, he was basically the Omaha MVP and guided Florida to a national championship appearance. He was excellent and still holds the record, by the way, for home runs hit in Omaha. And now he's kind of doing it again. He saw his average dip to 217 after a 1-for-16 stretch over six games through April 8th. Then he didn't play again until April 27th. Since then, he's 14-for-39 with four home runs, four doubles, and 13 RBIs. I'm going to invest in the guy who gets hot at the right time and see if that can maybe score me a point. Who's your pitcher?
I like it. And that's a very sneaky pick because you hit the nail on the head with Ty Evans. And he does have a knack for getting hot at the right time. And my arm, I was wrestling with a few as you were running through Ty Evans. Man, this is a tough one because there are a handful. But I'll go with J.B. Middleton from Southern Miss. He's certainly in contention. It's really just him versus Jacob Morrison for Sun Belt Pitcher of the Year at this point. Both have very strong cases. Both have been outstanding this year. But I'll take J.B. And this year he's pitched his way to a 2.07 ERA with 104 Ks to just 23 walks and 91 and a third innings. He's always had a big arm, big-time arm strength, has been highly praised and highly regarded for the pure stuff he has ever since he stepped foot on campus. But this is really the first season in which it's all come together. And ironically enough, it's also been his first season pitching full-time in the rotation. But as I said, it's big time stuff. He's got a mid to upper 90s fastball, pairs it with two very effective off-speed offerings and a breaking ball and a changeup that is flash. So I think that his streak continues and he turns in a good start or a good couple of appearances this week for Southern Miss. Now, somewhat of a bold pick by me because there's also an argument to be made that I should have saved him for regionals, if not super regionals, because I think he's really going to show up then and turn in a legit lights out quality start. But I'll take him this week. I feel confident in it. And I think he's going to continue to throw the ball well.
I'm going to tell you something, Peter. It's a good thing that you picked him because if you didn't, you were losing him to me. That was my pick.
No way. Great minds.
On the mound. So you have stolen J.B. Middleton. He's now off the board for the rest of the season. I'm now thinking off the top of my head quickly about who I'm going to replace him with because of you. And I've landed on kind of an interesting one that I don't think we've talked about him much on the podcast. It's kind of surprisingly, but Ryan Borberg from Dallas Baptist, the righty from Dallas Baptist, has been very quietly excellent so far this season. He's the only starting pitcher on that staff with an ERA that's below 4. He's been extremely effective, doesn't necessarily miss a ton of bats, but the stuff is actually reasonably impressive. He's got a solid low 90s fastball that can spin a little bit. It's got some good ride through the zone. He throws a sinker that's been up to 96 miles per hour, throws a cutter, a slider that it's basically a slowed down version of his cutter, and a solid changeup. So 5 pitch mix. He comes from an interesting arm slot. He's got, you know, pretty good movement on all of his pitches. And again, the results have been there. So I know that Dallas Baptist has been reasonably high on him throughout the entire year. And this even dates back to the preseason. I know that having had conversations with head coach Dan Heefner, they're really impressed by Borberg and think that he's somebody that's kind of flown under the radar. And so hopefully we can give him a little shine and he can help out Team Rudner here with a week one win in the postseason. So just to recap, it's Carson Tinney and Ty Evans against JB Middleton, who I was going to pick, and Ryan Borberg for the first week of the postseason.
I love it. I may have gone with the bigger names, but I'm a huge fan of the two guys that you selected. So it might go against my best interest, but I'll be pulling for him to have good weeks. Not as good weeks as JB Middleton and Carson Tinney, but good weeks nonetheless.
Well, Peter, it's time for you to have a good week. It's final thoughts time. And, you're on fire right now. So let's see if you can keep swinging a hot stick.
Oh, geez, Louise. I don't know. It's hard to just not be like overly excited and super, super fired up about the postseason and all that it brings. Like, you've so much action as we ran through from the top 8 national seed, the top 16 hosting seeds, the bubble in general. Like, there's so much to play for. I think we're about to see college baseball in its purest form and what makes the game so great. And it's kids playing really, really hard for schools that they love, potentially and unfortunately for the last time. And I think that throughout the next month plus, you're going to see a whole lot of leaving it on the field and playing the game super, super hard. So I encourage everyone to tune in. It's sure to be a blast. And I think all these kids are going to put on a show.
You know, my final thought and my brain in general is starting to shift towards the various carousels that exist across our college landscape. For example, the coaching carousel is already getting hot. We've seen a lot of mid-major changes already. We've seen Chris Lemonis get fired over at Mississippi State. There are a couple other high major programs that I think could be in an interesting spot, depending on how the next couple weeks shake out. I mean, we talked about Arizona State being in this precarious bubble situation that's below its standards. Texas A&M, it's no secret at this point that, you know, they've had a miserable season and they may even miss the postseason, and that could create some change over there. So my eyes are on that. My eyes are also, though, on the carousel at the player level, because I think that now more than ever, we are in an era of college sports where the transfer portal has made things just as unpredictable as the coaching carousel can. We see guys entering the portal at a rate that we've never seen before. There are already hundreds of Division I players, whether they're from schools with coaching changes, whether they're graduate transfers who can enter the portal at any time, already enter the portal. And we know that there are thousands more coming, not just from the Division I ranks, but from all over college sports. There are already thousands of guys from the non-Division I's in the portal already. And that level of turnover and change is really fascinating to me. So I'll be curious to see, as all of this is going on and the race for Omaha and a national title is unfolding, so too will be these next year roster constructions. The other problem with college sports right now, in my opinion, is that there is no breathing room. There's no separation between going and competing for a national title, if you've gotten your team to that point, and, you know, trying to figure out what you're going to look like a year from now and how you're going to compete for a title again for a season that hasn't even started yet. So who's able to strike that balance the best? Which players enter the portal? Who's able to secure them, and how the coaching carousel influences some of that movement is very quietly where my mind is starting to shift, as much as I am excited, as you pointed out, for the end of year festivities that come with, you know, conference tournaments and regionals and supers, and obviously the College World Series.
I love it. All very well said.
Well, that's going to do it for this week's episode of the College Baseball Podcast. I would encourage you, before we sign off here, to go on over to baseballamerica.com/college to check out all of our college baseball content. We are posting now more than ever. Lots of postseason focused things, including the Field of 64, which again comes out on Wednesday, May 21st, and then every day after that until Selection Monday, including one on Selection Monday morning. We have feature stories coming out. We have more prediction type content. We have the Bubble Watch We have some features that are coming out next week that we'll have another podcast before, so we'll brag about them one more time before then, that I'm really excited about. We have draft rankings that are constantly being updated this time of year. There is so much going on truly over at Baseball America. And so again, I would encourage you to go on over to the website and check out all that good written content. But for the podcast, this is going to do it for this week's episode. And Peter and I will see you next week after Selection Monday.